It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at a proposal to eliminate or drastically reduce the job of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, which has come under a lot of scrutiny in recent years.
First, polls have closed in Scotland today in what's expected to be a very close vote on independence from the United Kingdom. So we brought in our resident Central Time historian for a view from this side of the Atlantic and look at how Scottish independence compares to secession movements in the United States.
Jonathan Pollock is with us. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month for some historical perspective on the latest news. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, before we get into American history, it seems like this Scottish thing has captured a lot of people's imagination. Do you think some people have a rooting interest here in the U.S. on what happens today?
I think definitely. I mean, I think there are a bunch of different rooting interests. That the most obvious one is that I think we often forget the Scottish contributions to U.S. history, that there's a long, long, long Scottish presence in British North America and the United States to follow. And often, I mean, you know, especially in Wisconsin, there's plenty of people of Scottish descent, but we often think about German ethnicity in Wisconsin and Norwegian and other Scandinavians and so forth. And this is kind of for Americans who are of Scottish descent. And I think even for Americans who kind of take that for granted and don't think about it a whole lot, it's really their moment in the sun. They're really identifying with this. They're interested. They're kind of, thinking about their ties back to their home country. They're looking at Scottish independence and American independence in some kind of context. And also, I think Americans really love elections. I mean, the way we cover elections, where it's a horse race, you know, when it's election season, or if you're living in a state when primary time is coming up, even people who aren't, you know, always talking politics, or all of a sudden they're interested. There's that kind of horse race aspect. And in Scotland, where oftentimes Americans don't take a great deal of interest in even like Canadian or Mexican elections that are relatively close by, in Scotland, the differences are really stark. You know, Scotland's going to remain part of the UK, or it's going to be an independent country in some fashion. There's a lot of big questions there, a lot of potential. And so, yeah, I think Americans are really following this election.
Do you think that Americans are really vested stakeholders in the outcome? Or is it more like you said, you know, like watching a really good high stakes football game where, you know, no matter what happens, you'll go, and then you'll go and you'll have a drink or something, relax and forget about
have
it.
Have a belt
for the
of scotch. Yeah. So, I think it's more kind of the latter. I mean, given that we're not totally sure what would happen if Scotland actually votes yes and becomes independent, and what the nature of that independence will be, and what that means for the pound as the currency and its membership in the European Union and so forth, that I think the deeper ramifications people aren't necessarily thinking about, or we just don't know what the story is. But yeah, as a fun event to follow, the football game metaphor is a good one. In a lot of ways, I think it's like how, you know, when I've met people who are living in the United States during an election year here, where they get kind of caught up in it and they'll ask about, well, what do you think of this candidate? And why do people support that candidate and so forth? Even though at the end of it all, they're going back to their home country and relations probably aren't going to change all that much. It's still it's a fun thing to follow. And again, because the questions are so – because it's such an obvious yes-no, that you don't have to have a deep understanding of the Labour Party or the Conservative Party and what they stand for to follow along.
Well, and part of what makes it fun is that, hey, the map could change. Sorry, cartographers out there. But nobody's going to die over this.
This is true, yeah. And unlike other secessionist movements we've talked about in the past, and unlike many of them throughout European and world history, there really isn't a war that's going on underneath. It's not as though there have been skirmishes along the border of England and Scotland, and or that British businesses have been attacked in Edinburgh and so forth. It's a very peaceful kind of split, which also makes it all the more interesting that we're accustomed in the U.S. I think, of course, the Civil War comes to mind for people, where it's a deep seated and bloody issue in a bunch of ways. And then the idea of, all right, so it's a movement to secede that's supremely peaceful. What's up with that? We want to learn more about it and find out what's going on.
Are there other instances that follow that Scottish model where it's incredibly civil? You know, we'd really rather not be part of your country anymore. Thank you very much, and we'd like to vote instead of something that's a lot more bloody.
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly, definitely in the United States, there isn't really a case of that. I mean, we could look at like the composition of individual states, which is sort of akin to nations and sort of not. you know, it seems to me like Rob, when we were corresponding about this, you mentioned West Virginia becoming a state, breaking away from Virginia in 1863. And so that was kind of the middle of the Civil War. I mean, that in some ways, you know, there wasn't a renewed offensive into West Virginia to take back Charleston and bring it back into Virginia or anything. But at the same time, there was a war on. And so it was pretty supremely bloody in context. Veronica, I'd say no. I'd say for the most part, secession is usually a, you know, it's either a byproduct of a war or a revolution. It's usually, it precipitates one in some cases. As you were formulating the question, I was kind of racking my brain, my late afternoon brain here, and trying to think of times where countries have just kind of voted to opt out. And I'm not really thinking of it. I mean, I guess the one thing I can think of is if we look at, if I remember this correctly, and callers keep me honest on this one, if we're thinking about like the independence of Slovenia in the late 1980s, there were certainly plenty of wars going on as Yugoslavia was breaking up, and it's become kind of a metaphor for what can happen when a country breaks into smaller parts. But to the best of my knowledge, Slovenia didn't have anywhere near the same kind of conflict that Bosnia or Croatia or Serbia or Kosovo had during that time. Generally, secession is a really heated and bloody issue.
Well, let's get to a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi. Steve, are you there? Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, you're on the air now. What did you want to bring up?
Hey, I hope the yes vote goes through for the Scottish folk. We went to visit Scotland last year and spent a lot of time in the Highlands and the Outer Hebrides. The sentiment was, you know, separate. They wanted to be separate. They wanted the yes vote to pass. But it was interesting, they felt a connection to us, and several folks referred to us as their American cousins. We were both in the same situation, trying to, you know, at some point in history, get away from British rule. I thought that was interesting.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. In a way, the United States seceded, or it was a colony, so I don't know if it counts the same. Canada, Australia, in similar ways, devolved power down to them. He has a rooting interest. He's a pro Scotland independence there. Thoughts on what he had to say, John?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question I'm curious about what – I mean, in some ways, I guess the issues are somewhat similar. I mean, the issue of the relationship between the central – that the central government in London doesn't represent the people in the area that's looking to secede – I'd say that's definitely a close correspondence between Scottish independence and U.S. independence over 200 years ago. But I think where the difference is that the tension that existed was much less. I mean, the American Revolution came on the heels of years of kind of guerrilla warfare of various types, of increasingly inflammatory language about the British. And also, I think, as a result of less integration between the colonies and England, that there's an ocean separating them. And in the 1700s, that's really a huge, huge amount of space in a whole bunch of ways, where Scotland's been intimately tied to England since before the American Revolution, since 1707. I'd be curious to hear if more callers have ideas about, if other callers have visited Scotland, what exactly are the specific issues driving the independence vote?
Well, let's take another caller now, and we're going to go next to Dennis in Ripon. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. As I recall, I believe it was in the mid to late 60s, wasn't there talk about the UP and northern Wisconsin trying to become the state of Superior?
Okay, interesting, Dennis. Yeah, I think I've caught wind of that before. Tell us about
that,
John.
This is one that Rob and I kicked this one around also, and I looked into it. And I mean, and certainly from a Michigan perspective, and particularly before the Mackinac Bridge was constructed, the UP really was kind of like a separate state. It was remote from Lansing and from the major industrial cities of southern Michigan and Detroit and Flint and Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids and such. And so as a result, the UP was a very different place. It had a very different set of interests than downstate Michigan and so forth. But my sense of the Superior campaign was, on the one hand, it was kind of rooted in state tax policies and policies that favored like the auto industry, which is basically absent in the UP. There's not a whole lot of auto up there. It was mining centered and so forth. And there's not really mining in southern Michigan to any great extent. But that beyond that general economic picture, it was kind of an absurd thing. It was kind of a way to, you know, something to put on a T-shirt. It was a way for people of taking their like regional pride and putting something behind it. even though most people said that, you know, the movement had nowhere near the kind of success, even getting on the ballot, as we're seeing in Scotland.
But in that case, maybe it would have the effect of drawing attention and saying, hey, you guys down there in the South got to pay attention to us. Whereas, and even in this Scottish case, the leaders of all British parties, main British parties, have said, even if you guys fail, we're going to try to devolve some more power to you.
Well, and this is true. And I think that's one of the characteristics of secession movements in the U.S., even post-Civil War, when there haven't been armed efforts for states to break away or states to break up into smaller parts and so forth, that secession is definitely a way of really putting an issue on the table. And if people are getting to that point, it's a sign they feel their interests aren't being met, whether in their state capital or in Washington.
We're talking right now with Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident Central Time historian. We're looking at today's independence vote in Scotland and how it compares and contrasts with secession movements in American history.
And we want to hear from you. Were you rooting one way or another on the Scottish vote? Is it a story you've been following? And are there lessons here for the rest of the world, maybe for us in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We continue our conversation about the history of secession movements in the United States. A Scotland vote today on whether or not to leave the United Kingdom.
And you could join the conversation with your thoughts on what's going on in Scotland. Are you hoping for an outcome one way or another? And do you think that there are lessons, comparisons, contrasts with things that have happened in American history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, before we get back to the calls, I mean, obviously the biggie, we've touched on it when it comes to secession here, the secession movements leading up to the Civil War. History, GRE, essay question for you, John, compare and contrast.
Yeah, well, this is why I bombed the GREs. seriously, I bombed the GREs. No, I mean that's huge. I mean it's almost you can't compare the two of them. I mean, if we're talking about the Civil War in the United States, we can find all kinds of violent skirmishes between the two sides, where you know people are killed for. Or beaten severely for criticizing the South or so forth. And Scotland, as we've been saying, the whole debate, I mean, on the one hand, is much more long-lasting, that, you know, we could look at the big picture and go back 300 years and look at what happened to Scots Gaelic, to the language of Scotland, as Scotland became increasingly absorbed into the UK. And you can find, you know, examples of people holding on to their culture and rebellion and so forth in times where the British government is more or less concerned with suppressing Scots Gaelic language and culture and so forth, and other times where they celebrate it. But I think it's a much longer term for one thing. And again, there's just a lot less violence involved. Even the rhetoric, you know, the rhetoric about North and South in the U.S. going back to the early 19th century. Is really charged and angry and accusatory in the way that we're just not, at least I'm not seeing in the coverage of the Scottish election, that it's a much more kind of it's more of kind of an idealistic thing. It's just kind of like, oh, hey, why not? Let's try it out. Maybe we're just tired of, you know, it's partly disillusionment with present day British politics. But what I think is interesting about it is that, you know, disillusionment with politics in the pre-Civil War era was like South Carolina saying, okay, we're not going to let U.S. customs agents collect taxes in Charleston Harbor. We're going to prevent them from being there, and Congress had to intervene and so forth. And in Scotland, it's like, yeah, we really don't like the Tory government down there in London, so we're going to form our own country. You know, it's a very different level of intensity, I think.
And before we get back to our callers, I want to ask you, no matter what happens tomorrow morning, do you see this as sort of simmering away on the back burner no matter what?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the pro-independence side, the yes vote in Scotland, has really made enough of a case for it. It's become a global issue now. It's become something that, you know, people far afield from Scotland are watching and curious to see what's going to happen. And so as a result, I think when Scottish interests or Scottish party, Scottish National Party, in conjunction with other parties that are opposed to the leadership in England, they'll be able to make a stronger case for it. They'll be able to kind of point to this, even if they lose the election, as, oh, well, you know, so the yes vote lost by 5 points last time. If you keep this up, we'll call another election and maybe this time we'll win. So it kind of, I think it serves as a terrific bargaining chip for Scottish interests. Regardless of the outcome.
go back to our callers now. We've got Rod on the line in Madison. Rod, hi.
Hi. My comment is, when thinking of other peaceful secessionist movements, we can't forget one of the biggest ethnic groups we have in Wisconsin are the Norwegians. And Norway's separation from Sweden at the beginning of the 20th century was peaceful, and they had an arrangement very similar to the UK, where they had some local independence, but they were caught up in nationalism and got their freedom from Sweden.
Rod, thanks a lot for the call. I will admit to not being as up on the history there as I should be, but maybe an example that we can look to here.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent example. So it shows that it is possible. It shows that countries that have different traditions and a different national history can split apart without a revolution. That's a great first step, and I'm eager to hear more.
And I'm going to ask you this next one. I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or not, John, but a listener wants to know, how well is Scotland set up to be an independent country? Strong enough economy? Can it stand on its own?
Wow. It's a great question. I have to admit I'm not an expert on contemporary Scotland, but from what I've been reading, we're not really sure. I mean, I think one of the big questions comes down to what's Scotland's currency? You know, does Scotland stay on the pound? Do they adopt the euro? Once you look at the currency question, that's going to have a big part in the Scottish economy, in an independent Scottish economy. What's going to happen to banking? What's going to happen to British industry? You know, there are all kinds of threats about that you're starting to hear from the anti-independence forces about the dire things that will face Scotland once it becomes independent. So that's where it's really hard to tell. I mean, we know that Scotland's present prosperity, it's a fairly prosperous area in present, comes from North Sea oil. We don't know how much oil is down there. We don't know how long that'll hold out. For companies like BP doing business in Scotland, how much money would BP share with an independent Scotland? To what point would Scotland force BP to pay higher taxes and so forth? It's a lot. It's what ifs on top of what ifs. So we're not really sure. I mean, yeah, we know Scotland's not destitute. We know England's not destitute. That Scotland would immediately, the economy would crash instantly if they declared independence. Again, the moderate nature of this movement, peaceful nature of this movement doesn't, you know, lead us to see like squads of Scottish police going in and seizing the means of production or anything in that line. But still, anything more specific than that is really hard to foresee.
Go back to our callers with Aaron in Reedstown now. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up, and I don't know if the historian here, your guest, knows of this, but the history of Vermont and how they had remained their own republic all the way up till 1792 and did not join the rest of the Union until they signed, if I remember correctly, what was called the Moscow Covenant with George Washington, that deemed that Vermont will join the Union, but is allowed to secede at any time it wanted to if the Union did not live up to its moral standards.
Yeah, so I'm right. I knew that the Vermont was independent, was an independent republic from roughly 1792. So 15 years of Vermont independence. During that time, it was fairly thinly settled. The nature of its government was pretty small. And I know that Vermont has actually been – there's been voices about Vermont seceding from the U.S. or parts of the Northeast Kingdom, the northeastern part of Vermont, seceding from the rest of Vermont, and citing documents from back in the brief era of Vermontese independence. I don't know the exact substance of it. I don't know the exact clause, whether that's there or not. That sounds logical. But I think in practice, after people have kind of voiced them at a town hall meeting in Vermont – and they've been disillusioned with what's going on in Washington or disillusioned with what's happening in Burlington, that people have kind of walked out of there and said, yeah, this is great. This is time to secede. And by the time they read about it in the papers the next morning or talk about it in the light of the day, they're just like, oh, that's a crazy idea. That's not going to work. And it kind of dies down. Again, it becomes kind of a more concrete way, as we've said before, of establishing Vermont as having this kind of unique and quirky set of qualities to it that distinguish it from New York or New Hampshire, but not actually moving towards serious secession.
And John, just briefly, in our last moments, you know, again, no matter what happens tomorrow, will the fact of this and the fact that it has become such a cause of interest lend any sort of oomph to closet secessionists out there, no matter where they are, say, hey, if Scotland can get this out there, maybe we can.
That's a great question. Yeah. And I guess, you know, so if the vote goes yes, and if Scotland secedes, and whether that is a peaceful transition of power or whether it causes economic chaos or something, then, yeah, the lessons of that, the eventual outcome of Scottish independence, if it happens, would definitely be a signal to people who are pondering other movements, and how well that goes will determine what the nature of that signal is.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident historian here at Central Time.
Coming up, we'll look at a proposal from a Wisconsin congressman to more or less eliminate the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, spurred in part by botched operations in Milwaukee.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll look at the life of a Wisconsinite who is the only American woman ordered to be executed by Adolf Hitler.
First, Wisconsin Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner has introduced legislation yesterday aimed at eliminating the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. In a statement, Sensenbrenner called the ATF a largely duplicative, scandal-ridden agency that lacks a clear mission.
Among other things, the agency has come under close scrutiny in recent years after high-profile sting operations gone wrong, including cases in Milwaukee and elsewhere. It's not the first time there's been a legislative call to end that agency, but is this the time it sticks?
Joining us now is John Diedrich. He's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been working on an ongoing investigative series into the ATF called Backfire. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the proposal itself. What does it say?
Well, so this proposal, what it would do is not so much dissolve the ATF, though that language comes up, but really take the parts of the agency that are not duplicated elsewhere and fold them into other agencies. So, for instance, most of the operations of the ATF that involve enforcement of the nation's gun laws and so forth would go to the FBI. There are portions of it that would also go to the DEA and the Treasury Department. And then those parts that duplicate, say, going after violent crime and so forth, that's perhaps duplicated by other agencies, those missions would end.
Okay, well, that takes care of the part of his statement that calls the agency duplicative. The rest of it says it is scandal-ridden and lacking in a clear mission. How does that come into play in this?
Well, the agency's had a series of high-profile problems. Our series, as you alluded to at the beginning, looked at a series of storefront operations. This was a technique that was used not only in Milwaukee but across the country. And what we found is uncovered a series of problems and mistakes that happened throughout. For instance, the operation here in Milwaukee was promoted by an individual who had a low IQ, and this was a factor that came up in operations across the country, individuals with low IQs, mental disabilities, that were used to promote these operations, and then they were turned around and being charged. They arrested some of the wrong people. They ended up increasing crimes in certain areas. An agent in Milwaukee lost his machine gun, which has still not been recovered. So we found a series of problems in the Milwaukee operation, then in operations across the country. And this comes in the wake of the Fast and Furious problem, the Operation Fast and Furious, which has generated a lot of scrutiny into the ATF, and that's where agents in the southwest part of the United States in Arizona watched as a couple thousand weapons passed in the hands of criminals and ultimately ended up at crime scenes, mostly in Mexico, but also at the crime scene where a U.S. border agent was killed.
Now, how big a deal would this be should it pass? And in essence, how many people work at the ATF and what is their budget?
Well, they have about 4,700 employees right now, and they have just over $1 billion budget. What's interesting is the agency is sort of at a crossroads right now in terms of its personnel. About a third of the agency is eligible for retirement, and the agency's had a hard time filling its ranks and keeping up with that attrition rate. So that came up in a GAO report recently. So this would be one of the reasons why Sensenbrenner our Representative Sensenbrenner and others who are looking at this are suggesting this might be a good time to do this. So in terms of the impact, what we're looking at is a somewhat of a phased-in plan. It would, if this did pass, it would immediately halt the hiring ability of ATF. And then in 6 months, it requires a report to come from the FBI, ATF, DEA, and other entities to say, okay, how would you parse out the responsibilities that aren't duplicated to these other agencies? And then finally, after a year, the agency would effectively go away, and its functions as they remain would go to these other agencies.
Now, there are people who are saying, you know, hang on a second, the agency was without a director for several years. Let's give it a chance to turn itself around. What do you see as the argument there?
Well, it's true. They were without a director for 7 years, and B. Todd Jones came in as the director within the past year, a little bit more than a year. And that has been the argument, not only of – what's interesting is this proposal has generated opposition from both gun rights and gun control groups. So, groups that naturally tend to probably disagree about a lot on issues agree about this, but for slightly different reasons, we suspect. A point in terms of the director, it was 7 years. And the reason they didn't have a director for that long was about 8 years ago, Representative Sensenbrenner, among others, passed a proposal or a provision in the law that required that the director be confirmed by Congress, by the Senate. And that took a very long time to happen. In fact, through Republican and Democrat administrations, that was not able to be passed. Finally, Todd Jones came in. And what the folks are saying who are supporting keeping the agency and giving the director a chance is, hey, he's only had a year. On the other side, the folks who are critics are saying, well, look, I mean, Todd Jones was acting director for a period of time. He was in office the entire time that the Milwaukee operation happened. It was briefed repeatedly up at headquarters. So he had a chance during this time. And essentially, these operations happened on his watch, whether as acting director or permanent director.
Now, this isn't the first time that a politician has proposed eliminating the ATF. The last time it was 1993, Democratic Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Do you see the two efforts as being similar, or are they pretty much different animals?
Well, the bills are very different. I mean, Conyers' bill was just a a reckless bill, but a very brief bill with not a lot of details as to how it would work, and it just dissolved the agency. And this was largely in reaction to what had happened in Waco, and this is the Branch Davidian standoff that happened, where a number of these separatist group were killed in this firefight, along with some agents from the ATF. So a really disastrous operation. Ruby Ridge, where there was a standoff with separatist Randy Weaver. It happened not too long before this. So there were a few of these really high-profile events that had happened. And Conyers, who's a Democrat, proposed this. It didn't go anywhere. And I should say that this proposal, as the time that it's being introduced in the legislature, anything's possible, but it would seem to have very dim chances at this point of passing. What's intriguing, though, from a from a political standpoint, is that this proposal is getting some interest from both Democrats and Republicans, again, possibly for different reasons. Some of the Democrats and some of the left-leaning groups are suggesting that gun control is such an important function that leaving it within an agency that has had so many problems really diminishes the opportunity or the ability to regulate guns effectively. And they suspect that the FBI, there's a center called the American Center for Progress, is that their argument is, and they support this, is that the FBI would be much less vulnerable to political pressure from the NRA and other groups as the ATF is. And so there may be some interesting, bedfellows coming together in this proposal. But at this point, all Sensenbrenner has is one sponsor. There's the bill still being circulated on the Hill, and it doesn't. I should say there is one provision too that has gotten the ire of some liberal groups, is that this bill does preserve a restriction on the public release of trace data, and that's been a lightning rod requirement on the ATF. And what that means is that the agency, and this would be the FBI if they took over that part of the ATF's operations, would not be able to disclose how many crime guns are sold by a particular gun dealer. And that information has been shielded from the public for about 8 years. That would continue under Sensenbrenner's bill.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've been speaking to John Dietrich, a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he's been working on an investigative series on the ATF called Backfire.
Time for Curious Wisconsin. One of the people who resisted Nazi Germany from the inside was Milwaukee-born Mildred Fish Harnack, a University of Wisconsin graduate who, with her husband, went to Germany and became increasingly involved in the dangerous politics of the times.
We'll hear her story now from Joe Waldinger, who produced a documentary about Mildred Fish Harnack for Wisconsin Public Television. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, how did Mildred Fish Harnack become so interested in German politics?
Well, I think part of it was where she grew up. At the time she was living in Milwaukee, it was the most German of American cities. It was also socialist politics. The fact that there was a socialist mayor, it was the largest American city that had a socialist mayor and a socialist city council. So there were left-leaning ideas from when she was a child, even growing up in Milwaukee. And of course, these were Germans who brought these political ideas to Milwaukee.
And were Mildred and her husband socialists themselves?
Well, you know, that's really hard to say. They were definitely left-leaning. They were progressive. Her family said that she became that way when she came here and got educated in Madison. But, you know, when they went to Germany, they saw a need and a need to fight against what Hitler was espousing to the German people. A lot of people would say, well, okay, she was communist. Well, she never joined the Communist Party. She had a very strong interest in Russia. But what she was interested in was women's rights at the time in Russia, equal pay for women, maternity leave, in the case of divorce, child support, maternity, time off, all those types of things that we don't really look as radical or as communist. She was more left-leaning, progressive, possibly socialist, never joined the Communist Party. She did join the Nazi Party, so I can tell people that, but she did that in order to continue to work to survive. So her politics were definitely left-leaning.
Was that unusual for a woman of that era to be that deeply politically active? And she also had not just anti-Nazi sentiments, she had feminist sentiments.
Absolutely. She was, as many people say, many years ahead of her time. You know, even with her name being a hyphenated name, she kept her maiden name when she got married. But she was very well known, educated woman. She had her master's degree. She was teaching at Berlin University, the first American to teach at Berlin University.
Was she there already before Hitler came to power in 1933?
She arrived in 1929. So she met her husband here, who was a German scholar. He actually went back to Germany without her after they had gotten married, and she joined him. Ended up in Berlin teaching. He was finishing his several degrees, one in law and one in economics, and then joined her in Berlin. So she saw the rise of what was happening there, and actually it's documented in letters. She wrote her mother almost every week, and the first letters were very much of, my life is full from sunup to sundown in Berlin. What a wonderful city. And then those letters started to change when Hitler came to power, and you can see she started even writing code, writing the opposite of what she meant.
Well, you said that she joined the Nazi Party undercover. Does that mean that she and her husband were spies?
Well, she joined the Nazi Party in order to keep a teaching job. Her husband refused and didn't join until 1937, which was like the last possible moment. He was a government employee, which was really unusual not to have joined the party until that late. But I would say, yes, that was part of the reason that they did it, if anybody questioned them. She was definitely providing, helping to provide the Americans with information. Her husband had economic information. He worked in the economics department in Germany. The Americans wanted to know where the Germans had their assets as they prepared for the war. Mildred was known to have traveled around Europe gathering documents in order to get Jewish friends out and even Jewish strangers out of the country. And we also know that the group that they were involved in, this resistance circle in Berlin, provided military information to the Russians.
And do we know if she came to the Americans or if the Americans recruited her to provide that information?
It's an interesting story. Mildred was one of the first people to meet Ambassador Dodd and his daughter Martha Dodd when they arrived in Berlin. She actually met them at the train station. She was part of an American women's group there that welcomed them. Her and Martha Dodd, the ambassador's daughter, became very good friends. So she was often in the U.S. Embassy. And in later years, when the Americans were looking for financial information, they had an in because they knew that her husband worked in the economics department.
So World War II era Germany, Nazi Party, Adolf Hitler, it's dangerous stuff, right? How rough did it get for her while she was over there?
It got very rough. She lost a lot of weight. She was having a hard time getting enough food. But her friends always said the Harnacks were the first to give away their food and their medicine and whatever else someone needed. It got very tense for her. And at one point, Arvid bought her a ticket out, a boat ticket. He wanted her to leave. She said, absolutely not. My place is next to you. I'm staying here. There's still work to be done. And when she was arrested, that boat ticket was found in her purse.
People who knew her, I mean, did it make sense to them that she would have this devotion and this intensity against a known risk?
Well, it's funny. She came back to the States in 1937, and she was very hush-hush about what she was doing in Germany. She did not talk about the secret life that she had at all. And in fact, a lot of her family members believed that she had, quote, gone Nazi, which couldn't have been further from the truth. But she was very much aware of the risk. She was very much tormented by the long hours that they were putting in and the risk involved. And as women in this group, there were 18 women, which, again, is a very telltale sign of the important role that the women played in this group. They had the most dangerous roles. She was a recruiter. She also handled top secrets and information and relayed it from one point to the next. So, you know, trying to recruit someone, it's easy to get caught when you talk to the wrong person. And then also transporting secret papers. I mean, there's documentation and eyewitness accounts of rendezvous that she held in certain parks in Berlin with other people who were undercover.
And how did she get caught?
She got caught because of a Soviet blunder. The Soviets were desperate for information. Over the years, Arvid had had several contacts within the Russian embassy in Berlin. Stalin kept purging those people, though, and so those contacts kept changing. And at one point during the war, the Russians were desperate to get information, and instead of using their code names, they actually transmitted in code the Harnack's name and their address, along with two other members of the group and their address. And so about 9 months later, the Germans decoded this information, and there were the names and the addresses spelled out, not the code names that the Soviets had given the Harnacks.
Now, I understand that Hitler himself took a personal interest in Mildred's case.
It's true. We don't know exactly why. There's some speculation that they may have met at one point, and that meeting might not have went very well. She was well known in Berlin as one being the wife of this high-ranking German official. She had contacts in the U.S. Embassy. She was also an educated teacher, and people knew her in Berlin. They said she was tall and she was beautiful, and they believe Hitler may have wanted to meet her. And he went to the night school where she was at, and that meeting didn't go very well. There's no way that we can prove that this meeting happened, but it explains why maybe she was treated differently, held in isolation when she was in prison, not allowed to speak or interact with any other female prisoners. She was the only American in their custody at that time. And it's said that, you know, her sentence originally was 6 years prison, 6 years hard labor, and Hitler had to sign off on this, and he refused to, along with another woman who was German. Again, he was embarrassed. He was stunned by the size of this group and what information they had had, because they came from all levels of society, and Hitler, in his huge ego, thought, I am being supported by all Germans, and this group proved that he was not.
Do we have any sense of what her time was like in jail, in isolation, before she was executed?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Two of her cellmates, years later, one, Arvid had left a farewell letter for Mildred that he gave her on the night before their trial started, and Mildred passed that letter on to her cellmate, who 10 years after the war returned it to the Harnack family, because that was Mildred's wish. And this way, the Harnacks got in contact then with two people who had actually seen Mildred in prison, and they had talked about how sickly she had become, how she was treated differently than the other female prisoners, how she was held in isolation. But she also had a stub of a pencil and did a lot of writing, and that seemed to soothe her in her final days. But she had, her hair had grown completely gray within a four-month period of when she was imprisoned.
She was ultimately executed by beheading. Was that common practice for the Nazis at the time?
Well, there were 18 guillotines in operation at that time in Nazi Germany, but believe it or not, that was the most humane way of execution, is what they believed. Her husband was actually hanged by a short rope, which was a Nazi torture technique specifically designed for this group because it prolonged the death. So the guillotine was actually viewed as something more humane.
So looking back on her life, what she sacrificed, how she died, What did they accomplish, she and her husband?
It's a good question. And I asked that question to a family member, and they said the only thing they were successful at is getting themselves killed, which in one sense, you can look at it that way, because they provided the Americans a lot of financial information, but the Americans were more interested at that time, not so much in what was happening to the Jews, but how this might affect the stock market in this country. And they also had warned the Russians 9 months before the Germans had broken their pact and invaded the Soviet Union, and Stalin thought it was a ruse. He thought it was propaganda, and so he completely ignored that information. So here's this great bit of information that may have changed the war, and the Russians completely ignored it, although we do know that she did help people escape, get out of Germany. She provided comfort for those Jews who were left behind. We just don't know how many. So it's really uncertain how successful they were.
Joel, fascinating story. Briefly, what led you to follow this thread?
I was on a German-American journalism fellowship and went to former Gestapo headquarters, and there was her picture, and it said University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a brief paragraph about her, and I was like, who is this lady and why don't I know anything about her? Came back here to the States, did a little bit of research on her and found her there really wasn't much, but a day in Wisconsin public schools, September 16th, is a day of recognition, and a kid had kids in the public schools and they didn't know about her either, so that was my motivation to go out and find more.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about her.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Joel Waldinger. He produced the Wisconsin Public Television documentary, Wisconsin's Nazi Resistance, the Mildred Fish Harnack story. He joined us for this week's installment of Curious Wisconsin.